Hi, this is the On the Keys podcast, and I'm your host, David Kaiser. Thanks for tuning in. On this show, the inner workings of music, and the latest and greatest for the piano. Also stories, lore, and an altogether relaxing and educational good time. Where history is important, but new composers given their due. It's the On the Keys podcast, a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Please subscribe wherever you can find podcasts and tell your friends. I promise they'll enjoy it. It's educational. From South Carolina Public Radio, this is On the Keys, an hour of piano music played by virtuoso pianists. I'm David Kaiser. The piano world is hungry for more. Hungry for pianists like the one featured on this program. You might have not heard of this pianist, but I hope after this show, you'll find a deep appreciation for his art. This is a special program about the pianist and teacher, Sidney Foster.
There's that old truism that it's an international language. Despite its triteness, it's really true. We do communicate.
I want to give thanks right off the bat. By the way, that's Mr. Foster you hear in the background. So now, in no particular order, those that made this show possible. Former students, Imelda Delgado, Hans Popel, Mary Parekh, and Carlisle Floyd. Also, Sidney's son, Justin Foster, and Barbara Benedett at Curtis. Also, Lauren Buca, Margaret from the Florence Library, and Nicholas Gordon from Music Mountain. Also, Donald Minoldi at IPAM, the International Piano Archives of Maryland. Sidney Foster, a story in music that started in Florence, South Carolina, and produced riveting live performances, some of which you will hear tonight, and ended with the teacher that got his students to say, "One more thing I learned from Foster was," just when I was ready to kill the interview. Foster passed away at the age of 59 in 1977. He taught while at Indiana University a whole generation of pianists that have settled in South Carolina and surrounding states. Foster's father, Louis Finkelstein, immigrated from Kiev via Ellis Island, ending up in Florence, South Carolina. He set up a jewelry shop on East Evans Street and worked with his wife, Anna Diamond. East Evans Street now consists of a few businesses, a single lane road, a few small houses. And much of West Evans Street is the same, except for different tenants. Hattie Finkelstein, an aunt, lived down West Evans Street a few blocks. She was a music teacher for a few years in the area. I wonder if any of our listeners know someone who took lessons with her. Sidney, born in 1917, was the first of four kids. Father Louis played piano, but business was booming, so Anna Diamond, Sidney's mother, spent many hours away from home at the family business. A young African-American man named John, and we don't know John's last name, was hired to watch the children. John encouraged Sidney to play and make up music on the piano, a skill that got him into trouble later, as you'll learn, but informed so much of his professional teaching and performing career. Sidney, encouraged by John's enthusiasm, got so good at the instrument that by 5 years of age he gave his debut concert at a local ladies' club. And there ends his time spent in South Carolina. The Finkelsteins, Sidney would change his name later, moved to Miami in 1925. The Florence Morning News reports, Louis Finkelstein, who has been in the jewelry business in Florence for the past 11 years, announced yesterday that he purchased a store in Miami, Florida. He has made many staunch friends in the PD section, who will receive this news with genuine regret. Plans are now being made by Mr. Finkelstein to close out at great sacrifices his stock of jewelry on East Evans Street and other holdings in Florence. Unquote. The Finkelsteins left, but their family's musical influence under the Foster name would stay in the state for years to come. A number of former students who studied with Sidney Foster at Indiana University have settled here.
I am Mary Parekh. My husband and I own Rice Music House, and I am a native of South Carolina. And I studied with Foster as an undergraduate at Indiana from 1970 to 1974. But I knew of him because my teacher at Augusta, Artemisia Thebus, did her master's with him. And he came and did two master classes in Augusta when I was in high school.
Like tendrils that sneak into every crevice, schools, thoughts, and ways of playing the piano and expressing music have been passed down from teachers to students over generations. New ideas and personal opinions are added to the mix, and the geographic region where this happens has its own unique and rich culture. Take South Carolina, Sidney's home state.
It's fascinating to me, but there's some really strong schools of piano playing or piano teacher playing in South Carolina.
I would like to hear these.
Well, I don't. You know the. You've heard of Mona and Wendell Keeney, I'm sure. They taught at Furman for years and taught a lot of the teachers that taught me. So I studied with Ernestine Smith out of Greenville. They were Maté performed teachers. You know, they studied the Maté technique.
The Tobias?
Yeah, Tobias Maté. And that kind of got taught a lot in that area and throughout. And then, you know, as opposed to what was happening here, it could be fascinating to follow it through. Because I, you know,
so that was the upstate.
Yeah, Richard Cass was studied with Mona and Wendell Keeney at Furman.
At Furman.
Yeah.
So do you know Columbia area?
You know, it's so funny because I grew up in North Augusta, and in my family, we went across the bridge to Augusta every day, like five times a day, but I never even thought about coming to USC or study. I didn't know what was going on over here because I was so focused with Augusta. And when I went to Brevard, I got involved with Ernestine Smith and people from Converse, and that was kind of my musical trajectory was that way. My great-grandfather was a violinist who traveled around the world on the boats. He got ill and he recuperated. He was in Savannah and he recuperated in Augusta. So he ended up staying there and he brought his family over. My grandfather, his son, was a harpist. All of them were musicians, harp, flute, and violin. And my grandfather studied and played the harp. And he played on the boats like Sullivan's Island to Charleston before the bridge was built. And then he studied in Philadelphia and substituted with the Philadelphia Symphony. And this is a long story. You want to hear it? He met his wife because he went to get his harp fixed. And my great-grandfather, Campiglia, was the only harp maker east of the Mississippi. And he went there and he met my grandmother. So we have one of the harps still that my great-grandfather built. My grandfather played a lot in Augusta. He went to Aiken quite frequently to play parties there. He played for Taft, President Taft, when he came to Augusta. And Hoffman was at one of the parties he played at. And my cousin tells the story. She knows it better than I. Papa said that he was over in the corner behind the palm trees playing, and someone made a toast to Hoffman as a toast the musician, and he said, no, no, no. Came over to my grandfather and said, let's toast the true musician here. This was my grandfather. That's the story with Joseph Hoffman.
This Joseph Hoffman, Sidney would meet in Miami. Meanwhile, business was growing after the new move. Sidney's father was consumed by work, nothing new, real estate this time, often upwards to 18 hours a day. He came home and demanded silence in the house, which meant no practicing music. However, Sidney's mother got him started studying with Earl Chester Smith at the University of Miami. Here's where Joseph Hoffman, one of the most famous pianists of all time, enters the story.
I go by Imelda Delgado, and at one of these competitions, at one of these performances, you know, this little boy played, and Hoffman heard him, and he granted him, you know, an audience, in a scholarship to the Curtis, because he was so impressed, you know, by him.
Hoffman must have heard him somewhere in Miami, and suggested the Curtis Institute of Music, which at that time in 1927 required tuition. It would be free from 1928 on. Sidney's mother, Anna, secured the necessary funding. About $6,000 a year in today's money, not including other costs like rent and food. Sidney Foster would go on to actually attend the famed Curtis Institute twice. During his time there, classmates included George Bolette, Jacques Abram, Abby Simon, Shura Tchaikovsky, Samuel Barber, and Giancarlo Menotti, to name a few.
Here at Music Mountain in Falls Village, Connecticut, with Sidney Foster, today's soloist with the Berkshire String Quartet at Music Mountain. Mr. Foster, welcome, as always.
Thank you very much.
Do you recall what was the first time you played at Music Mountain? How many years ago?
It wouldn't be hard for me to figure out. I know that I went to Indiana University to teach there in 1952, and I met the members of the Berkshire Quartet, who, as you know, in the season or in residence there, and they invited me to play that very first summer.
I didn't even know Sidney Foster's name when I went to Bloomington, which shocks me in retrospect. I went there because somebody told me it was a really good music school and they have all kinds of good teachers. Hans Bopel, I'm a professor of music at the Department of Music at Santa Clara University in Santa Clara, California. I'm also a department chair. My girlfriend's father was a cellist who admired Janos Starker very much, and Janos Starker's accompanist was Georgi Shebok, and so he thought that I should study with Georgi Shebok. But I knew only one person in Bloomington at the time, and his name was Harry Farbman, and he was not only a violin professor, but the conductor of two orchestras. One is the Redlands Bowl Symphony, and the other one in Springfield, Illinois. And so I met up with the Farbmans for a dinner there when I got there, and they said, well, there's only one person you should be studying with, and that's Sidney Foster. And then their daughter, Patty Farbman, had studied with him for a number of years, and so I met him. That way. First knocked on his door. Of course, the Farbmans told Sidney about me and we arranged an audition, but I hadn't met him. And when he said, well, I already have 28 students, and if I can possibly resist you, I will. I've never forgotten that. It was so funny, because you're only supposed to have 18 students. That's a full load. Okay. And he had 28 students at the time, everywhere from undergraduates to doctorates. So I played for him. He says, well, I can't resist you. And so I became his 29th student.
The recordings on this program can be found on the Ovation to Sidney Foster CD, released by IPM Records. Visit SC Public Radio for more information. Curtis in 1927. At this time, Curtis was only 3 years old. Mary Louise Curtis Bach, a philanthropist, had purchased three mansions in Rittenhouse Square in Philly and had them joined together. Prime real estate. So let me mention that from now on in this program, Sidney will be referred to with his chosen surname Foster, not Finkelstein.
Said, you know, it's such a long name. You really need a name that is going to be more marketable. And I would recommend that you change your name to something more American and shorter. And so it was on the advice of Erno Rappé. He conducted in the Radio City Music Hall Orchestra. And then the whole family adopted the Foster name.
The year before Sidney Foster enrolled, a one Mr. Beno Moiseevich, on the faculty at one point, gave a recital there in November, which included the Waldstein Sonata and Etudes by Chopin. The next year saw Wanda Landowska at the harpsichord and piano in a themed recital featuring music of the Gallant style. Her program notes reading, "We now witness the engrossing spectacle of the transition from the grand manner to the gallant style." The next recital Sidney Foster could not have missed, because it featured his first teacher at Curtis, Isabel Vengarova. The program included, besides the usual fare, a sonata by Alexander Glazunov. As a teacher, Vengarova was excruciatingly methodic. Foster said, quote, "All of us feared her, for she was quick to erupt if we displeased her by not doing what she thought she had made clear in our lesson. When I obviously, though unintentionally, displeased her, her voice rose to a shrill pitch, 'No, no, no,' as she stood up over my music. She slashed over and over with a pencil. I became frightened, so I stood up and ran toward the studio door. At the same time, she rolled up my music and hurled it towards me. But an hour later, when I walked in the Curtis corridors, she appeared, having left her studio, and sweetly greeted me with, 'Hello, Sidney.'
My name is Imelda Delgado. I married a pediatrician, and his name is Cortez, but I go by Imelda Delgado. And I studied Little College, Del Mar College in Corpus Christi, Texas. And at the time that I was studying there, there was another university in Corpus Christi. It was a Baptist school, Corpus Christi State University, where J.B. Floyd taught. He was a young teacher there. And his students and then my teacher's students would get together and play recitals. I left for University of Texas to finish a bachelor's degree. When I finished the bachelor's degree, I felt like I really needed to do much more work. I had gotten discouraged, I guess, developed problems physically. I had been a very free player, but I was asked not to move around so much, to stay close to the keys. It's all in the book, by the way.
Imelda Delgado is a pianist and author of the book, An Intimate Portrait of Sidney Foster, which was used as an important source for this show.
But anyway, when I got ready to leave to get a master's degree, I called my teacher in Corpus Christi and I said, Mr. Montana, I would like some advice about where to go from here. So he contacted J.B. Floyd, who had been a teacher at CCSU, and at the time was studying with Sidney Foster at Indiana. And he said, J.B., where do you think she should come to Indiana University and study with Sidney Foster, to the recommendation of J.B. Floyd, who incidentally is still in Florida, I believe. He just retired from teaching in Miami, University of Miami.
You are listening to On the Keys. I'm David Kaiser. Find pictures of Sidney Foster and his students at our website, scpublicradio.org. For a moment, let's zoom ahead in time. It's nearing 1941, and the Japanese were about to bomb Pearl Harbor. Sidney was in his early 20s, and success came quickly. He won the first Leventritt competition in New York. The program for his Carnegie Hall debut recital in 1941 stated this. At the famous Musical Institute, he was regarded as a young rebel, it being his ability to attend classes with his puppy in tow, and other such unconventional practices. The authorities asked him to leave. One of the last performances that Sidney Foster played during his first stint at Curtis was on a recital with students of Vingorova. Sidney Foster, about 12 years old, played small pieces by Tchaikovsky, Mozart, and Mendelssohn. On the same program, Samuel Barber played two piano pieces by Brahms and Ravel's Sonatine. This was his last performance because Curtis, like the program for his Carnegie Hall debut said, asked him to leave. Maybe E.S. Drummond has the answer. One of Sidney's piano music teachers at Curtis wrote, "Report on Sidney Finkelstein after about 10 weeks' work. When I first started giving Sidney Finkelstein piano lessons, I was very much hopeful that I am at the present moment. The child has had 3 hours of work with me a week, and after much effort on all our parts, is now doing 3 hours a day of practice. He is essentially not a student, either for his tutor or for myself, and has great difficulty in thinking things through for himself. He needs someone to practice and study with him and really get him down to work every minute of the time. It bores him very much to stay on one thing very long. He learns with much difficulty, notes, time, etc., and uses his ear more than his brain. When he finally does get a thing, he has a certain style of his own in playing it, and a rhythmic feeling, but accuracy is not essential in his mind as long as he gets a certain swing. He has good hands, some facility, but is much less trouble for him to use them wrongly than rightly. He is essentially a preparatory student. It might be years before he'll be ready for the Curtis, and it is very much a question in my mind, at the present, as to whether he will eventually be a musician. He scribbles symphonies and sonatas at every possible moment that are just a jumble of notes with no time for form. I have a number of times tried to show him things in theory, but he is much more interested in his own methods of composing. He has no fear of anybody or anything and absolute confidence in his own preferences. In short, very much of an individualist. I think he is slowly commencing to realize that music means work and not jazzing all over the piano. And his attitude is better, I think. He has received too much attention for his improvising and has imbibed rather false notions of its importance. In some respects, he reminds me of what George Antel must have been like at his age. In 10 weeks' time, he has learned a couple of Czerny etudes, a Clementi sonata, a couple of elementary Bach pieces, a Schubert dance, and some scales and arpeggios. All of them would bear much criticism. Whew! And so says E.S. Drummond, this mysterious teacher. Let me remind my listeners that Sidney was 12 years old at the time. What can you expect? Anyway, Drummond must have been quite the patient but pedantic teacher, obviously. And no doubt there are thousands of piano teachers who can identify with them. Then it was decided by Curtis officials that Sidney Foster should be dismissed from school. He was sent home on a train, accompanied by a one Mr. Eastman. Just imagine how this must have felt to a young boy, inspired by music. It must have been crushing and quite traumatic. This account is according to Curtis Records. But some insist that two men with nefarious purposes stole money from the young boy, and in order to protect themselves from being caught, persuaded the boy, Sidney Finkelstein, Sidney Foster, to drop out of school. Besides, the boy was rather unruly, so expulsion was relatively easy to justify. And so goes the story. Take it or leave it.
Okay. Well, I probably won't get to Hoffman this week, but maybe next week I'll start looking around.
Yeah, or just by chance, you know how those things.
Curtis's
yeah.
halls are filled with all sorts of lore, verified and secretly exalted, and many secrets. Not to mention the gossip that surrounds Joseph Hoffman, and the first teachers himself.
Hello, you've reached Barbara Benedett, AV Desk at the Rock Resource Center, Curtis Institute of Music. I'm not at my desk right now. Please leave me a brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you.
Record your message at the tone. When you are finished, hang up or press pound for more options.
Controller's office or something. They were stealing funds. He had a lady in Miami that became sort of his... someone that believed in him and gave him funds, and so they would write to her and they'd say, Mrs. So-and-so, little Sidney has to have, you know, a suit or something, and, you know, he's married, blah, blah, blah. And so she would, they soaked her for some money, two people that worked in the offices there at Curtis.
Because, I mean, Curtis so was... Then, was free at 19 was from 1928 on it was free, so this would be money for living expenses and food.
Evidently he was a little kid at the time,
right?
Anyway, he did, I guess, you know, little kids things that you know might be considered a silly, but these two men took advantage, two people took advantage of the fact that he was getting, you know, money from Miami. Then, when they were about to be discovered that they had been, you know, stealing
from a little boy.
From the little boy, yeah. They went to the little boy and said, "Well, you know, you've been a bad boy, and you're going to have to leave." And they were covering their you know, derrieres is what they were doing.
So we didn't find out who these men were. Is that?
I think they did, but I don't know their names. I didn't get that information. But they, you know, and they discovered, that's why they Sidney Foster could go back to study with him, because at the time that he graduated from high school in New Orleans, you know, he was getting ready to go to Juilliard, and he called for a recommendation there at Curtis and said, you know, I need, you know, they need to know that my record is straight, that there was no truth to all the hanky panky that went on when I was a child there. But they need to know that at the Juilliard so that I can be accepted and go there. And they said, well, you don't have to go to Juilliard. You can come back here. And so that's why he went back to the Curtis.
Right.
And so I won't pretend that I'm a modernist. I'm not. I'm afraid I'm an old-fashioned, what Glenn Gould calls, curator at a museum. I open the piano lid, and I bring out, and I hope, though at least bring to life, old things that are worth chewing over and enjoying.
So that your concern, as I guess many people's, is that
What happened after Sidney Foster was dismissed from Curtis is a mystery. Something changed within him, and he transformed himself into a competent pianist. Maybe with help from a few of these teachers. He eventually reapplied to Curtis as a young man, and would then prove everything that his old teacher E.S. Drummond had to say. In the years in between, he studied with Walter Goldstein, instructor of harmony and piano at the Newcomb School of Music in New Orleans, and excelled, winning of all things a grand piano in a local competition. He also took lessons with Arthur Newsted and Winfred Mullen.
Her name was Augusta Zuckerman, but she went under the name Mana-Zucca Castle, and she was a performer and composer that lived in, resided there in Miami, and she had, you know, been I think a soloist with the New York Philharmonic herself when she was a little kid, but anyway, she heard Mr. Foster play when he was a little kid, and advised him not to cut your hair for a year while at the Curtis, to hide your large ears.
Return to Curtis. As a student of the somber perfectionist David Saperton, I found that Sidney Foster performed in a Thursday evening student recital in 1935. He played movements from Brahms' Great F Minor Sonata, and almost exactly a year later, he played Franck's Prelude, Chorale, and Fugue, and pieces by Debussy. In May, he performed in a recital for the score reading and transposition class, playing his arrangement of the overture to the Magic Flute. So improvisation and composition lived on with him, much to, I'm sure, E.S. Drummond's chagrin. That is all he is down for playing in recitals. Curtis's record may be incomplete. After graduation, he excelled, winning competitions like the first Leventret that launched the careers of many pianists like Van Cliburn, Gary Graffman, Alexis Weissenberg, John Browning, Eugene Nisteman, just to name a few. He also married, and since he was keeping Curtis up to date with his post-graduation activities, including pleading to marry Curtis for money like everybody did at the time, he sent in a letter about the union, which was even more forthcoming because he married another Curtis student, Branya Singer. Branya and Sidney were on the same stage together romantically in the 1938 Curtis graduation commencement.
Whenever you're ready, I'm ready.
Okay. I'm Barbara Benedette, and I'm the digital archivist at the Curtis Institute. It's dated January 9th, 1940. Dear Mrs. Bach, like so many Curtis graduates, we too have gone and done it, making still longer the long list of those who have been joined together in their life's work by Curtis. We feel that we too, equipped as we are with the knowledge and heritage which has become ours, have a strong foundation for a successful future. Our life together at present is promising since we are both engaged in teaching. Enclosed are the criticisms of, I can't read that word, our just plaudit, I'm not sure what that is, which we hope pleases you. We feel it is a small one in the nature of many to come. With our warmest greetings, we are sincerely Branya Singer Foster and Sidney Foster.
Great, thank you.
They're wonderful people. When I first went to Indiana, you know, they were little kids, you know. Well, Lincoln was 15 and Justin was, I guess, 12. I think they're 2 or 3 years apart. But we've grown old together. So anyway, I felt like they were my cerebral family. You know, when I left Texas,
okay.
They were just good to all of us. You know, all of his students. We felt like we were their children, cerebral children, and you know all. You know, the many things that I learned, apart from my family also, the values I got from Sidney Foster and his wife, Branya.
he was amazing. He was the first person. One day I was, you know, my wife and I were going to go to Chicago for something. And I can't remember what it was, but he said, here, I want you to take $50. And he gave me like a $50 bill. And I said, oh, Sydney, no, thank you. That's okay. He says, no. If you need it, you'll be glad you have it. If you don't need it, just give it back, that sort of thing. And he was the first adult who I ever knew who was truly generous. In other words, there was no implied, therefore you owe me something. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
My own father was sort of, I'm giving you this, so you owe me that. You know, there was a sort of this implied, it wasn't just a no strings attached gift. He was generous in the extreme that way. So there was this generosity, and he was also somebody who had students at his home. His home became a second home for many students. Not all teachers are that way, but you could always drop in at the Fosters, and he had many dinners with students, and he and his wife, Bronya, were two of the most generous and hospitable people ever. Also, he never once raised his voice to me. Never raised it above a mezzo forte.
Even if you came maybe unprepared?
I never came unprepared. I didn't come on. He did once say to me, he brought tears to my eyes once. It was early on, and we were working on the summer before I went to college. I had won a big competition in Long Beach, California to play with the orchestra there in February. So that was 6 months ahead. It was played the Rachmaninoff Rhapsody, which I had actually played for a number of years. And so around November, it came time to start bringing back the Rhapsody for these February movies. And so we were working on it, and I said once or something like that, well, that's not how I do it. And then I said it a second time, well, this is the way I do it. And he said, Hans, you've got to think about this. You can't serve two masters here. And he meant you have to be open to things. And it was said it very quietly, but it went to the core. And that was the official sort of breaking of the umbilical cord that I needed from my teacher of 12 years. You know,
we were a number of works that are really worthy of playing in today's repertory and that will attract audience. Do you find a particular American composer that is appealing to you, whose works are well received when you play them, or a number of such?
Well, now I wish you hadn't asked me that question, because now you date me. I remember when I played Prokofiev for my teacher, he said, you cannot get away with that kind of thing. That's impossible. You're perpetrating it upon the people. And I must tell you that although I had no sympathy for that attitude on his part and couldn't fathom what must have given him that kind of limitation, I must tell you that I have it myself. And I think that it's that we are not conditioned. We are not taught in those formative years the vocabulary, the language that we need to know in order to understand today. And so I won't pretend that I'm a modernist. I'm not. I'm afraid I'm an old-fashioned one.
Thank you.
2 years after his Curtis graduation, he gave his New York concerto debut, performing Beethoven's 3rd piano concerto at Carnegie Hall, with John Barbaroli conducting the New York Philharmonic. Foster used his own cadenza for the occasion. Find a recording of it on scpublicradio.org with yours truly at the piano. The recordings on this program can be found on the Ovation to Sidney Foster CD, released by IPAM Records. Visit SC Public Radio for more information. Mr. Foster played regularly at Carnegie Hall the rest of his life. In 1966, he gave what would be his final recital there. And here's a good anecdote about what other pianists thought about Sidney Foster. A few days before this recital, Emil Golaus, the great Russian pianist, was in town to perform the first of two recitals in December. On the 13th of the same month, Sidney Foster played Rachmaninoff's Piano Sonata No. 2. Emil Golaus was in the audience, even though he was to play the very next evening. So then Golaus plays a superb recital, and though he was exhausted, he had spotted Branya Foster in the audience. And he said to her after calling her back, "Your husband gave a stunning performance of the Rachmaninoff Sonata." And this coming from one of the greatest Russian pianists of all time, concerning one of the most famous pieces for the piano by a Russian composer.
You may notice that he is taking care of his 99-year-old mother, Branya Foster.
Sadly, Branya Singer, Sidney Foster's beautiful wife, graduate of Curtis, and a wonderful pianist in her own right, passed away in March of 2016. She was born in 1916, a year before Sidney. Justin, their youngest son, took care of her in her old age. Foster students remember her as a welcoming presence at the Foster household in Indiana. You are listening to On the Keys. I'm David Kaiser. From a busy time as concert pianist in New York City, Foster then taught at Florida State University, and there he knew Carlisle Floyd.
My name is Carlisle
they were both on the
Floyd.
Faculty. But Mr. Floyd needed piano lessons, and Mr. Foster was happy to give them to him.
It was very, very thorough and very methodical, what I had with him. Well, I had just gotten my master's in piano, and I wasn't satisfied with the way I was playing. And so I asked Sidney if I could study with him, but we were colleagues at the time, although I was about 10 years younger than he was. As you probably found out, he was very blunt and also didn't suffer fools gladly, I would say. But I once was invited to a party there at home. They were forever giving parties here. And I went to the party late because I had to do something at the university. I forgot now what it was. But in any case, I was late arriving, and I knocked on the door. Sidney answered the door and said to me, "Oh, Carlisle, I'm so glad to see you. This is the kind of party I would leave unless I were giving it." That I remember. That's an example of his wit.
So then the Fosters finally settled after the stint in Florida in Bloomington, where he taught at Indiana University alongside George Paulette, Abby Simon, and at one time, his wife, Branya.
I have an interesting quote from George Paulette, though, just to give you an idea of the differences between them. I was at a master class at Brevard Music Center. I was just in the audience, and one of the students asked him about preparing for competitions and practicing and all that. And he said, "I can't help you there." He says, "I never had to practice." So there you go. I mean, and Foster would never have answered a question that way. I mean, he would have given you some kind of guidance or...
I was playing very advanced literature, but I was playing it very, very tight. And he had a way of, we called it the method, and he had a way of teaching his students how to relax, which is really profound, really profound. And it took about 6 or 8 weeks for me to adapt that. I pretty much had to stop everything to do that, and met with him 3 or 4 times a week for 5 or 10 minutes as he led me through this process. And that changed things enormously. It made piano playing very much easier to do. Expanded my stamina, for one thing. Another thing which was really profound was that I said, Sidney, you know, now that I'd never called him Sidney, I only did later on, so it was always Mr. Foster until even always. I said, you know, there's only one problem with changing this technique, is that I hate the way I sound. I sound so bland. And he said, you've always sounded that way. Now you're just relaxed enough to realize it, to actually be hearing yourself more objectively. Now let's work on your sound. And so that was a wonderful sort of revelation.
The end and the beginning of a legacy. Sidney was in the hospital in 1977 for a medical procedure, and sadly, in his weakened state, he was given food which he shouldn't have been given, and he tragically choked on it.
And the last time I saw him was in New York City, and I was attending the Levantrip competition just as an audience member, and he was judging. And we met out front, and we spoke, and he said something about, why don't you come back? And I really wanted to. I wrote him a letter to ask if I could come back to study with him. And then I found out through my former teacher in Augusta that he was very ill. So I never sent the letter, because he died then within that year.
I learned about his death from a mutual friend who called me when I was doing something professionally in Boston, as I remember. Who called me saying that they knew I would want to know. And indeed I did. I was shocked, though, as was everybody else who knew him. Very young. Yeah.
We knew he wasn't well, and we knew he was in Boston getting treatment. And he was on the mend, he was getting better, and then something happened, and he choked on some food, from what I understand. But he had heart problems from rather an early age, and he sort of defied estimates of his, you know, he took great care of himself, became a bit of an expert on nutrition and over the years, and so it was terrible.
Though his death came abruptly, he lives on certainly in our state through those that had the privilege of knowing him, and he lives like all the great pianists do, in the recordings. Recordings imperfect, but like Alfred Cortot, there's always something there to find and to discover, and to be moved by, as you most certainly experienced throughout this program.
Thank you.
that's our show. You've been listening to On the Keys, here on South Carolina Public Radio. I'm David Kaiser. You can find playlists for this program at our website, scpublicradio.org. The show's email address is keys@scpublicradio.org. Thanks again to all involved in this special program. In no particular order, Imelda Delgado, Hans Bopel, Mary Parekh, Carlisle Floyd, Cindy Sun, Justin Foster, Barbara Benedict at Curtis, Lauren Buca, Margaret from the Florence Library, Nicholas Gordon from Music Mountain, and Donald Minoldi at IPAM. You can find more stories about Mr. Foster in Imelda Delgado's book, An Intimate Portrait of Sidney Foster.